materials are very stiff as a magnet, very high coercive. If you took a very high coercive magnet, I think, neodymium, and you wanted to demagnetize it, I think you'd have to do a heroic effort to demagnetize it. It's a very steady magnet. There are other materials where degaussing and demagnetizing is a hell of a lot easier. Some of those materials, the second class of materials I just discovered, just discussed, I think it's possible to hit them with a hammer, create the right kind of a shock wave, and some of those magnetic domains flip over 180 degrees and north and south start reversing. That's a guess on my part. Over to you, Roy, T2IW.
And that was sort of the conclusion that was held at the end of the TechNet, that spontaneous reversal of magnetic domains. The problem, though, is that if you bang a piece of ferrous material and put it in, say, the Earth's magnetic field, the banging might kind of push the grain structure a little bit and have some of those grains reorient themselves across the magnetic field of the Earth. Banging it is just going to randomize it. It's not going to really reverse it unless there's some external field that's forcing it to reverse. So just snapping a magnet in half is probably not going to change the quality of the magnetism in those pieces of metal. You know, unless you use a welding iron and raise the temperature above the Curie point. So for all intents and purposes, it's the same material. It would happen if it was neodymium. It would happen if it was aluminum, nickel, cobalt. No matter what the magnet is, the same principle would follow through.
WS2N.
That's Wesley first, and then Paul.
Yeah, actually, domains are pretty much mechanical structure. So, you have a magnetized small micromagnet in the ferrite. And the ferrite is actually made from the grains of iron isolated between themselves. They were put to the water and let it rust it, and then put with the compound and squeezed. And that's how the ferrite is made. Let me drop. But obviously, magnets that we make right now are also made from grains, not that much isolated. That's why we can magnetize them, align all domains. So when you knock with the hammer, you simply do exactly the same as if you were to expose to the magnetic field from the coil, variable magnetic field. You just physically, with that hammer, disorienting the domains, magnetic domains. You may even make that weakly magnetized material completely not magnetized. And to achieve.
Wesley, as I said before, knocking it around will have it lose its magnetic quality. But unless it's exposed to an external magnetic field, banging it isn't going to impose a magnetic field upon it. There's no particular way that banging will ensure that the spin of each grain is aligned with each other, unless there's an external magnetic field to help alignment though.
No. You're simply disorienting. So if you have a vector north, let's say, of 10 magnetic domains inside the material, you can easily disorient 5 of them or 6 of them, and then when you disorient those domains, the rest of the magnetic domains are acting against the domains that are disoriented. So now the magnetic is completely not magnetized. It's right here.
Okay, again, I totally agree. You can bang a magnet to be non-magnetic. There's a bunch of different ways that it could lose its magnetism. One is through a lot of stress. The other is raising it to a point that's called the Curie point, the Curie temperature, in which the kinetic energy of the differing magnetic range domains is allowed to kind of randomize it. So left to its own, it randomizes and to a total zero of a magnetic dipole moment, and you have a piece of iron simply isn't magnetic at that time. So you can lose magnetism, but the trick is to try and get it to have the opposite magnetism to repel itself, if that's the reason one is searching for this particular question, answer. But the ultimate question answer is, you know, how is it repelling itself when it splits in one case and attracting itself when it splits in the other? And again, you're dancing around it, so you're coming precariously close to the answer. But let that fool just say something, because you have something.
Yeah, Roy, you were talking about banging your rods. I've done that experiment. I've taken a 6-foot steel threaded rod, and it doesn't have to be threaded, but that's what I had at the time. And I cut it in half, so now it's a 3-foot piece. And take that piece, and I used a hammer, and I pointed this thing toward the north, and it hit the back of the steel rod about 20 times with a good size heavy hammer, a regular lump hammer, about 2-pound weight hammer. So it's a good size hammer. And you hit that about 20 times. You can take that and put it down and pick that piece up. It's a very, very small piece of metal, but it will become magnetized. Notice that you can pick up maybe a piece of a paper clip, you know, or a staple, you know, something very light, which it will work. You take the other piece, the other 3-foot piece of steel threaded rod, and you point it in another direction, like to the west. You hit that about 20 times, and nothing happens. You put it next to that same staple, and it won't pick it up. It's just fascinating to do something like that. And the way I got this is because, let me drop it. Of reading about how scientists are able to tell how many times the magnetic poles have switched on the Earth and how long it's taken. Because if you go out to the middle of the ocean, lava is coming up out of these cracks all the time. And, you know, if it's coming up and then it solidifies right away when it hits the water. The magnetic field of the Earth is pointing north at one time. That will create a magnetic field pointing north. 50,000 years later, the same thing happens, and it could be, you know, a couple of feet away or a mile away. The magnetic field is set up facing the opposite direction. And if they have equipment, you have test equipment to find go along and read that. They can go along the bottom of the ocean and read all the different times the magnetic field has switched. Well, after reading that, they tell you that, you know, you could actually duplicate this by taking a rod and pointing it north. Naturally, I did that. And it does work. Back to you, Roy. WS1. Victor David Henry was coming.
Comment away.
Fine, this is WA2DDH, John. The case I've always seen is a bar magnet, when snapped in half, produced two new bar magnets, where each one was complete, and at the point of breakage, each half had the opposite pole of the remaining piece, so that the two ends where they just broke would attract. At least that's the way I remember seeing it on Mr. Wizard years ago. Go ahead.
Okay, so that explains why the broken magnet wants to repair itself and is attracted to itself. What about the situation that people report when they repel each other and you can't even put the things together?
Roy, I give you a precise answer. If your blood wall is vertical, but you cut it at 90 degrees to the blood wall, and then when it's vertical, and you cut it parallel to the blood wall, that's the answer. Enter it in.
I wonder also, Roy, if I separated the center of my thaw magnet with a Dremel tool, with a cutting wheel, I wonder if I get a different result from you, Roy.
You might get a very slight degradation because you probably would get a lot more thermal effects, and so you might reach the edges, and so the magnetic intensity would be a little bit low. But let me just answer the question. Like I said before, Wesley has come incredibly close, if not on it, except, I don't know, the terminology. I don't know if people kind of grasp the terminology. So let it drop, and if anyone has anything to say, they can say it. If not, I will give you the answer to this little one.
I'm going to repeat again. If you have a northern lead and a southern lead, after it's broken, it becomes northern lead on the left, south on the right, and then north on the left from the broken side, and south on the right. So the two parts will attract each other. However, if the original magnet looks like north on the top and south on the bottom, and you create a breakage, now, after it's broken, it becomes north on the top, south on the bottom, and the next one would be north on the top and south on the bottom. Therefore, the two parts will repel each other. And so is it.
Okay, Wesley, you just have to clear up for me these two pieces of the magnet. Are they next to each other, or is one above the other?
To each other.
You got cut off. Say it again, please.
Next to each other.
Okay, fine. Okay. Basically, you have... It's just, I don't know, the block wall, I think, just confuses people like myself. It just has to do with the fact that magnetic domains are oriented in particular positions. They're either horizontal, or they're vertical, or they're diagonal, but they're not kind of uniform. So if you have a bar magnet and you snap it in half with north and the south poles, you'll recreate a south pole from the top magnet and a north pole from the top of the bottom magnet that you split in half, and the north and the south will attract each other. If you split it at a right angle to the axis, then you're splitting it so that you have two halves of a magnet, the tops are both north, the bottoms are both south, and they're repelling each other. So it has to do with how you're splitting it according to the axis of the magnetic moment.
Professor, you said exactly the same what I said. It's a blotch wall, not a black wall. Blotch wall. It's the wall, it's the place between north and south when you have no magnetic domain oriented. And then you trying to say that you're breaking it at angle from the blood wall. I say that this is, it depends from what the breakage point is from the blood wall and orientation of that the breakage point. And to
agree, I've got something to say on this one. Roy, I think many of us are having a lot of trouble getting a mental picture of what's being discussed by Wes, you, and others. If I was cutting a 2x4 with a saw, I can do it as a cross cut or as a rip cut. Were you in this bar magnet, in one case doing a cross cut and another case a rip cut of the bar magnet? AC2GS to KQLAW.
Absolutely. In one, you're going parallel with the lines of force. With the other, you're going at a right angle to the lines of force. But the metaphor is perfect.
So the remaining pieces tend to retain the exact same direction of magnetism and polarity of magnetism before the cut and after the cut, as long as you haven't done the cut with a huge shock or run into a temperature increase where you've excited the curing point. By the way, I'm going to make a guess that what temperature really is average kinetic energy of the molecule, even a solid crystalline material. When you heat it up a lot, individual molecules are like balls on springs. They're really vibrating in place. And so beyond the so-called Curie temperature, where the amount of physical vibration of the individual crystals, so to speak, is so great that they become randomized in orientation, and therefore you lose magnetism. I'm guessing that that's the mechanism of Curie point temperature loss of magnetism. Over to you, Roy, K2LAW.
The VDH with a comet.
VDH.
Yeah, I guess I had assumed that the breakage was always going to be along the length of a bar magnet, where you were sort of breaking it in the center. But yes, I can see how that would work now. And I guess this is the reason that the divergence of B is zero, that there are no magnetic monopoles.
That's a biggie. That's one of Maxwell's four equations. And all that really means is that if you've ever seen any diagrams of lines of force with magnets, it always shows arrows going out, then looping back, then coming back in. No arrow that's just looping out and going on for infinity. They're all closed loops. And that's what divergence equals zero means in that Maxwell's equation. And that leads to the fact that, unfortunately, although there are some theoreticians who think that there's a magnetic monopole out there somewhere, nothing can find.
Well, I think magnetic monopole is theoretical, elementary particle. It doesn't exist in the way that we understand it.
Range. Metal isn't a solid crystal. It's made up of an amorphous number of small grain crystals. And each of those grain crystals assume a magnetic moment. And at a certain kinetic energy, those magnetic moments can be bumped out of its position. Otherwise, in ferromagnetic material, it has a tendency to lock together separate grain structures across the domain. And once it's locked together, they kind of lock each other in place and make it very, very stable. And that's the difference between ferromagnetism and paramagnetism. Although there are instances that are called paramagnetic, but they're actually just not ferromagnets at room temperature. There's something called holmium, which is a ferromagnet at 20 degrees Kelvin, I think. But since, you know, there's very little at 20 degrees Kelvin, we call it a paramagnetic. But that's the nature of magnetism in iron grain.
Well, the magnetic monopole doesn't exist. Maxwell equation doesn't disallow magnetic monopole.
Yes, but no one said Maxwell's equations are the ultimate. There are other people who have different opinions and theories.
Well, absolutely.
Yeah, since magnetic lines seem to have to always close, it's all the experience we've got, that would suggest that all the experience is telling us there's almost no possibility of a monopole magnet. Over to you, Roy.
I tend to agree. I mean, classically, there's no place for them, and I think even in quantum mechanics, there's very little place for them. But there are some theoreticians out there who are feverishly searching for things. So far, the only thing they've come close to are things that sort of kind of vaguely act like monopoles, but aren't. So I agree with you guys. I think that the search for the magnetic monopole is the search for the unicorn. But there are people out there still searching.
I have a question to you, Roy. What are we standing at? Impressed with your holding very strong to classical physics and classical science and such.
I think there's a great deal that we can learn out of classical physics and classical science in general, but you can't kind of throw away the new stuff either. I mean, really, if you think about quantum mechanics, it's really based upon wave mechanics that's classical. The whole theory of superposition and even the idea of quantum of values is very similar to the harmonics that you see in wave equations. You know, when you have a resonant antenna, it'll all accept multiples of that frequency. Isn't that a lot like quantum?
Well, classical physics is a part of quantum physics. Quantum physics is whole physics.
I wouldn't say it's whole physics because it doesn't really contain relativity, which is kind of an important part of physics as well.
Agreed. Very good.
Hey, I have another magnetic puzzle if anyone's interested. Okay, you put a little furry bunny in a non-magnetic cage, and you hoist them on something like a torsional pendulum. If you've ever seen a torsional pendulum, it's basically a rod with a string attached, so you can detect very, very light forces. And you put an equal weight on the other side of the rod from the bunny, and now you take a very, very strong magnet and you point it at the bunny rabbit. Do you think the bunny rabbit will come to you in the magnet, or do you think it will go away from you in the magnet, or do you think it will just sit there and look at you very, very puzzled?
I'm going to make a guess that there's enough iron in this red corpuscle that you might be able to detect with a very strong magnet an extremely small rotational force on your mechanism, where you're going to get some attraction of that rabbit to the magnet. It's a pure guess on my part. Roy, go ahead.
Okay, Dick. Anyone else either for or against that?
I'm for. I agree with Dick on that one, WS2N.
Okay, we'll get back to that in a minute, but that begs a bigger question. We're all familiar with magnetic resonance imaging, previously known as nuclear magnetic resonance, and that uses a very, very, very strong magnet. Now, assuming that blood is attractive to the magnet, wouldn't that be sort of dangerous in some ways? I mean, would you really want something to attract your blood while you're going for some kind of, investigative exam?
The amount of attraction of each milliliter or microliter of blood could be very, very small. Whereas on your torsional spring scale, with a very strong external magnet, your trying to attract the whole non-animal simultaneously, and you can just barely measure a rotational force, is my guess. On top of that, when you put that person in your MRI machine, I'm not quite sure how that's oriented. Is it oriented in the sagittal manner, the longitudinal manner, or whatever? But the human being is in the center of that magnet. Therefore, there is no preferential direction for his blood to be sucked to. Is it sucked to the north or sucked to the south? You know, toward his head or toward his feet? I think because he's in the center of that magnet, even if there's a slight amount of potential attraction of his blood, I think it becomes neutralized in that environment. Another guess on my part. Over to you, Roy. I bet you've made quite a few MRI pictures in your time.
Blood is diamagnetic. What is diamagnetic?
Well, fun anymore. Just kidding, Wesley. Magnetism. Magnetism comes in many flavors. Ferromagnetism, the ability to become a permanent magnet. Now, does anyone think that you have to have iron in a piece of permanent magnet or else it won't?
Aren't there more materials other than iron that can become magnetic?
Yes, indeed. Nickel, your nickel can be it can be a permanent magnet. Your cobalt can be a pure magnet. There are materials that aren't even ferromagnetic that when mixed together, like neodymium magnets, can be incredibly strong magnets. So yes, you could have nickel or cobalt or iron, and it could all be ferromagnetic. Now there's another thing called paramagnetic. Paramagnetic means that they're attracted to magnets, but once the magnetic field is shut down, they lose their magnetic polarity. They're not permanent magnets. In a magnetic field, they act like magnets. When you turn off the external magnetic field, they forget magnetism entirely. Let me drop it. Then there's something called diamagnetism. Diamagnetism is when the thing isn't magnet at all. It has a local repulsion to magnetic forces. Usually diamagnetic forces are something like 1,000 times weaker than ferromagnetic forces. So they're very difficult to figure out. But in a way, Wes is perfectly right, but in a way, Wes isn't perfectly right. There is no real free iron in a human body. It's all bound up in hemoglobin. And there's two types of hemoglobin. There's oxyhemoglobin and there's deoxyhemoglobin. And just to confuse matters, oxyhemoglobin is diamagnetic and deoxyhemoglobin is paramagnetic.
Only few materials are magnetic. Iron, nickel, cobalt, gondolium, neodymium, and samarium. And magnetism and diamagnetism has to do with the pair of electrons and the spin on the atomic structure of given material. And to extend, and actually, four free electrons on the iron makes it magnetic because they spin in the same way.
Didn't quite understand the last part about iron spinning the same way.
The four free electrons on you in the cloud of the iron atoms are spinning the same way, that means the same direction. That's what makes them magnetic.
From what you just told us about the two different states of blood, Roy, would lead me to believe that when you hold that magnet near the rabbit, you're going to get a very small amount of repulsion, not attraction. From what you told me, that would be my next guess. Would you, Roy?
Right? And for that, you would be perfectly correct. I think it's not the iron so much as it is the water, which is diamagnetic. But a lot of things, as Leslie said, is diamagnetic. Although the repulsion is so incredibly weak, you wouldn't notice it unless you had something like friction device and a really big neodymium magnet. I'm talking about something that's, you know, I don't know, a half a pound heavy. Something that you really would not want to put around anything that's terribly magnetic or it would break all the bones in your hand. So that is quite right. Little white rabbits will be repelled by the magnet.
I've seen an experiment, which I don't quite understand, where a small frog was put into an extremely strong magnetic field, and he was suspended in midair. What was your idea?
Well, that sounds like a demonstration of diamagnetism. You do need a hell of a lot of magnetic force to elevate even a frog. There's a lot of YouTubes out there. Graphite is very diamagnetic and relatively light. So you see a lot of YouTube where they have graphene floating of a neodymium magnet. Superconductors also have that interesting quality. They repel magnetic fields, and they can actually even freeze a magnetic field. If you take a superconductor and freeze it down in the presence of a magnetic field and then remove the magnetic field, it'll act as a magnet even though it's theoretically a diamagnetic material. So, yeah.
WS2N, Thomas.
Yes, Paul.
I remember seeing that frog somewhere, and that was a superconductivity experiment they were doing. So that's the same one, I think, the big one in the store. Some kind of a field that they set up to show that this thing was working. They actually had this frog floating inside. It wasn't touching the walls or anything. It was quite suspended. Back to you.
Yeah, usually they tend to be experiments that show diamagnetism. There was a interesting commercial, I forget exactly what it is. I'm sure Wesley remembers because he pointed me at that commercial of a levitating device. And what they had done was put a bunch of neodymium magnets encased in concrete on a track, and they had a bar of superconducting material, and they just poured liquid nitrogen into it until it was superconducting, and the diamagnetism levitated the jets across the track. You remember that, Wesley? Okay, maybe not. Let's just go back to what Wesley said about electron spinning. You have to understand that it's really not them spinning. If you really take that apart, it doesn't make a great deal of sense because it's actually, you can take a look at it two different ways. You could say it's just a quantum mechanical phenomena that's vaguely related to spinning. Or if you want to get esoteric and you took a little bit of electrical engineering classes, you could say it's very similar to the spinning angular momentum of a circularly polarized wave. Because it's the wave of the electron that's spinning. The charge is spinning, not the electron itself. Because if you figure out the angular momentum, it's h bar over 2. If you put it in the size that an electron can possibly be, the surface of the electron is traveling around faster than the speed of light, which Einstein said is a real no-no. So they don't really spin, and it confuses things to say they spin, but it's a quantum quality, similar to spin, but not quite.
Well, because you want the spins to add up, isn't there a relationship on magnetic materials where the outer valence electrons, there must be either an odd number or an even number must exist in order for the material to be magnetic? As you can tell, I haven't remembered it very well. W. Roy, T2RIW.
Yes,
yeah,
electrons fill in a very orderly way. They will fill opposing spins. So the first level only has two electrons. One will be plus or minus, and if the first one is plus 1/2, the second electron that enters has to be minus 1/2. So they cancel out. Then the second ring also has two electrons, and one is plus and one is minus. And then the next one is six electrons in three pairs. So you'll get a single one and two single ones and three single ones, and then the fourth one will pair up with the first one and balance out the spin. So the idea of mixing spin and why they're magnetic is they have unopposed spin. Now, a curious thing is obviously protons spin as well. So protons have a magnetic moment, but it's because it's charged and it spins. But what about a neutron? Neutrons have a magnetic moment, but they're not charged. So anyone have any idea why a neutron should have a magnetic moment? Okay. It's because it's a complex particle. It contains three charged particles called quarks. They sum up to a zero charge, but internally they have their own charge. And the neutron was discovered back in the 1930s, and within a few years they discovered it had a magnetic dipole moment. So they already knew that there was something strange and there was something inside a nucleus even back then, a neutron even back then. But they didn't have the faintest idea about quarks. But they sort of could sense it coming from way back in the 30s. So that's neutron's little story.
In other words, both spin and electric charge to the play. And the neutron has spin of one half of H and and this is, of course, net charge.
A hydrogen atom has only one electron and one proton. Is that a magnetic material? Particularly if I've got it in the liquid form and it's cryogenic and cool. Over to you, Roy, T2RIW.
It's paramagnetic. It's not ferromagnetic, but it is paramagnetic. But I'll give you a very, very similar question. You take a basin, you fill it with liquid nitrogen, you let it stand for a little while, not enough to have the liquid nitrogen evaporate. Then you take a very strong neodymium magnet, you tie it to a little string, you lower the string into the basin, and then you pull the magnet out. What do you think is attached to the magnet?
Frost. That's a joke.
Okay, any guesses from the audience?
Well, magnetic rush is a product of average magnetic field, and perpendicular to the area that penetrates, and that's from Faraday's law. But when you placing magnetic field in a very low temperature, then normal component of magnetic field that is passing through the surface is sort of frozen for the simplicity of the material.
I think you're overthinking it a wee bit, Wes. It's not rocket science. It's just a little trick of nature. Let's put it this way. Do you think the nitrogen is paramagnetic or diamagnetic?
They're magnetic.
Good. So if I tell you that something else comes up with that magnet when you pull it out of the liquid nitrogen bath that's been sitting there a while, any ideas of what the heck magnet is holding on to?
I have an idea. I don't know how to explain it. The flux freezing in magnetothermodynamics. And that is by direct differentiation. The magnetic flux freezing is the basic principle of ideal magnetohydrodynamics. I'm looking for the proper words to explain it.
Again, you're overthinking it, Wesley. You can simplify, simplify, simplify. What is around the basin?
A whole lot of frost and frosty air.
Exactly, frosty air. And what does frosty air contain?
In this case, nitrogen that has boiled off from the liquid.
What else does it contain?
Oxygen, nitrogen, moisture, all of which are, let me think now. Liquid nitrogen, 78 Kelvin. That's greater in temperature than the freezing temperature from oxygen. So the oxygen hasn't gone into liquid form. The nitrogen in the air maybe has, and the moisture in the air has made frost. So the frosty air around the base of the container is some kind of a crazy mixture of all of the above.
I think you might have the boiling point of oxygen mixed up with something else, because if you put out liquid nitrogen, oxygen will precipitate as its own liquid in it.
I suddenly realize you're absolutely right. AIL manufactured a product and dropped the food. It was called the highly precision hot cold noise source. It had two ideal 50 ohm resistors. One was being heated to 100 degrees centigrade, which is 383 Kelvin. The other 50 ohm resistor was being cooled in a bath of liquid nitrogen, and each of them had a coaxial cable connected to them. So you would take your low noise amplifier and connect it alternately to the hot resistor and the cold resistor, and depending on the difference in the noise power out of your amplifier being measured, you go through a formula and you find out what is the noise figure of the amplifier. The problem they had was that the oxygen would form into the coax cable, the air line coax cable on the cold source. Let me drop. And the 50 ohm cable started becoming something other than 50 ohms. A guy named Harvey Glass got a patent for solving the problem by taking the bath of liquid nitrogen, making it a closed container so that the liquid nitrogen that became gaseous nitrogen that was boiling off was forced through the air coaxial cable to purge the oxygen out of it. So I'm now realizing it's a pretty strong piece of evidence that oxygen will liquefy at a temperature higher than the 78 degrees of liquid nitrogen. Over to you, Roy, KQLIW.
Yes, exactly. Oxygen will liquefy and you'll get a mixture of liquid nitrogen and liquid oxygen. And Wesley, is liquid oxygen diamagnetic or paramagnetic?
Diamagnetic. No, I'm sorry. Yes.
I'm sorry, Wes. It's paramagnetic. Why would I go through all this if nothing happens? It's paramagnetic. So if you take a neodymium magnet and put it in a dish of liquid nitrogen that's been cooling for a little while, you'll get this big glob of liquid oxygen that will boil off over time, but it's paramagnetic. So that's what you get on the magnet, a big glob of liquid oxygen. And there's loads of YouTube that have people doing that all the time. It seems to fascinate people.
So, my understanding is that you have a sample in the presence of a slight magnetic field, and it's cooled below, let's say, superconducting transition temperature. So, the samples cancel nearly all internal magnetic fields. Do you agree with that?
Why you're complicating things with a superconducting material. There's no superconducting material in this particular experiment. It's simply a basin of liquid nitrogen exposed to room air.
I was trying to say that this effect is because the magnetic flux is conserved by superconductor, where the internal field decreases, the external your field increases. That the whole concept of Lexus, when they were making their floating slider, whatever, so that people were able to slide on and to exchange.
From what you just told us, Roy, if I have a dish of liquid nitrogen sitting on the table for a while, some local oxygen in the air is now condensing out and going into the liquid form. I'm not quite sure now, is liquid oxygen higher in buoyancy or lower in buoyancy than liquid nitrogen? But do we get a film of liquid oxygen on the surface of the liquid nitrogen, or do we get a film of liquid oxygen on the bottom of the container of the liquid nitrogen? Which happens? Over to Roy, K2IW.
That liquid oxygen is a little bit different than liquid nitrogen. I might be wrong. So it's a blob of liquid oxygen below the nitrogen that's boiling off.
So if I sit there and allow the boil-off to take place, does all the liquid nitrogen boil off first, and then, although I'm still getting some smoke out of that container, the last thing that happens is now I'm going to watch the liquid oxygen boil off.
Yeah, because the oxygen will boil off at a higher temperature, so it won't reach that temperature until most of the liquid nitrogen has boiled off first. So yeah, you'll get mostly the liquid nitrogen boiling off, and only towards the end, when there's very little liquid nitrogen, you'll get the oxygen boiling off.
Now, liquid nitrogen has a particular nearly clear color to it. Liquid oxygen, I think, has a slight, is it bluish or orangish color? In other words, if I start off with a very large container of liquid nitrogen, and I sit there and watch, and there's no local wind, and I let it slowly boil off, do I eventually have a liquid at the bottom of the container that has some other color that I might be able to recognize? Okay, Roy, K2IW.
As you said, liquid nitrogen with liquid oxygen has a blue tint to it. Whether you'd be able to see it with all the smoke created from the liquid nitrogen boiling off is problematic. But I've seen where they kind of distill out. Because you could do the same thing with oxygen and liquid nitrogen through a distillation device and distill out oxygen. And there are YouTubes of that. It's a nice, very nice pale blue color.
If I had some kind of a heat exchanger device, so I've got a coil of copper tubing inside of a bath of liquid nitrogen, and now I'm blowing air through that coil and allowing it to bubble off at the bottom of that of liquid nitrogen, therefore I'm increasing the amount of liquid oxygen I'm forming. It sounds to me like I could make myself a bath of liquid oxygen by doing that experiment. Okay, Roy, K2IW.
I mean, that's one way. The usual way that I see people do it, the cleanest way, because if you do it that way, you're always going to have some part liquid nitrogen, some part liquid oxygen, and a lot of these times people just want pure oxygen. So they just run a tank of oxygen gas through a distillation apparatus that the copper is running liquid nitrogen through, and the thing condenses rather nicely to pure oxygen. That's the easiest way to get pure oxygen. The other way, you'll have some kind of mixture.
I have a question.
NASA needs a lot of liquid oxygen for their rockets. Any idea how they form it? Over here, Roy.
You would assume hydrolysis is the easiest way of holding on to oxygen.
Now, I'm asking, how do they produce liquid oxygen? I have this great big tank. I want to fill it with liquid oxygen. I'm starting off with an empty tank. What do I do to generate liquid oxygen? Over to you.
They don't do it on site, WSLN.
Okay, wherever they do it, how do they do it?
That I don't know. They ship it in. Trucks and trucks and trucks. Hundreds of trucks. Just launch one space shuttle. It's unbelievable. And then they fill up those big round tanks you can see. Sometimes they are spherical tanks. They just fill them up. And then the truck goes back and brings in truck after truck. Where they're going to get it from is probably nearby, but how they actually do it, I don't know. Thank you.
You've got it, Roy.
I would assume the easiest method that I could come up with would be the hydrolysis of water. Water is relatively plentiful. Electrical power supplies are relatively plentiful. You put the two of them together and you have a means to produce an endless supply of both oxygen and hydrogen. If you're not interested in the hydrogen, you let it escape and then you have a lot of oxygen. To me.
Yes, I believe that will work. But it's going to take a lot of power to do that. If you've already got liquid nitrogen by some magic, and you can do it by liquefying air, and then by whatever means you separate the oxygen from any other contaminant, the total number of kilowatt hours of energy required to do it could be lower. There, I'm not sure. Tell me right.
Yes, it depends on your resources. If you're a big industrial company, it's easier to just pay for the electricity and be done with it. If you're some poor person who needs the oxygen to breathe, the best way is to just use a simple oxygen concentrator. Those are filters that actually filter out the oxygen from the oxygen-nitrogen mixture in the air. And so you can theoretically use those to concentrate, but on an industrial scale, you're probably more cost-effective to just go with something simple like electrolysis. I mean, it's an incredibly simple concept. They've been doing it since the 1800s.
How does an oxygen concentrator work?
It basically depends on a differential filtration system where oxygen and nitrogen don't go through the same passageway at the same rate. And so you tap the filter system off at the point where the two separate out, and you draw in the oxygen and you let the nitrogen go back into the air. So it's a glorified filtration system. It's very efficient, but it's you can't really get that much out of it. But you know, it requires very little weight and power resources. So it suits a affordable, low-yield oxygen concentration ability that people who need oxygen and they don't want to carry tanks around.
It is actually cheaper. It's a simple filter. You pump from the liquid. You pump the air to the filter, and it is able to get the heavier particles and the lighter particles out. Now, for the lighter particle out, you actually have a hose, a tiny, tiny hose, like a sponge. And then you are able to move them to different tubes. The rest of it is nitrogen that is actually going through. So that's how you do the separation. Enter here.
Is it going differentially through a membrane, Roy?
I would rather describe it as a porous material than a membrane, because that would get confused with osmotic pressure, which is not involved in this method.
Roy, I have a question. When you were talking about nitrogen, were you and the cold temperatures, were you referring to Meissner effect at the end of it?
Don't believe so.
Okay, so we are talking about the same stuff. Magnetic field lines represent the curvature around the object that is cold. That's what all internal magnetic flux is frozen. That's why you have suspended the magnet in the air in the cold temperature, don't you?
Yeah, that goes back to the previous discussion of that little commercial where they had levitating superconductors. Yeah, but the trouble is we're kind of talking about all kinds of things almost simultaneously, so it's difficult to kind of realize what part of the talk you're getting. But yeah, it's frozen magnetic line. But I have one more question for the audience, and it's a goodie and an oldie from the likes of Martin Gardner, who is a very famous guy who used to write for Scientific American. You are in a room with no metal objects except two iron rods. One of them is a magnet. How can you identify which one is the magnet?
Are there
any takers out there?
Are you allowed to touch the rods? Physically touch them?
Yes, you can touch them and you can position them any place that you would like to.
John just signed in. Go ahead, John.
Yeah, I think if you take one rod and slide it along the other rod, if it stays, if the attractive force is constant, then the one that's being slid is the magnet. If the attractive force peaks and then drops and then peaks again, the other one is the magnet. Go ahead.
The way I've heard it described is you take one rod and you take the pointed end towards the center of the other rod. If that creates attraction, the tip of the one is the magnetized one. So, in other words, even a magnetized rod, in the center, there is no magnetism, so to speak. So, if the tip of one rod is attracted to the center of the other rod, the one that has the tip that's touching, that is the magnet, which is similar to what John just said. Over to you, Roy.
One of the rods in the air on the team meeting to find out the victory.
Well, I was going to say, is it as a magnet, as a compass?
Kind of difficult. I mean, that's one of the alternative answers, but I find that kind of dubious because how are you really going to do that unless you have a lot of other equipment we float it or have it rotate. You know, if you have one of those axial devices, maybe. But usually in a random room, you're not going to have anything that you can pin a magnetized rod with the ability of having it rotate to align itself with the Earth's magnetic field. But that's the alternate answer to that question.
Right. You take one rod, you put it in the middle of another rod with the black hole.